Here it is!
From deep inside your audio device of choice.
AI to the rescue, smarter every day. From work to play, it leads the way. Innovation, creation, it's here to stay. AI makes life better. Hip hip hooray.
Hip hip hooray indeed. Thanks, Ralph, the talking computer. Ladies and gentlemen, OpenAI, that's the big one. One of the big ones, they're all big ones, has ruled out running advertisements on its platforms. At least for now. You know, there's always later. The move would make sense, says the British tech journal The Register, given the fact that the AI developer is trying to restructure as an entity that actually makes a profit. Doesn't do that now. It's a non-profit, kind of. And nothing makes profits like filling your head with ads. Chief Financial Officer of OpenAI says, while we are open to exploring other revenue streams in the future, we have no active plans to pursue advertising. That's a little different from previous comments by the same official reported by the Financial Times, saying OpenAI would be, quote, thoughtful about when and where we implement advertisements. OpenAI has hired individuals with marketing skills and experience in building ad platforms. OpenAI continues to burn through investor cash as it builds new AI models, more slowly improving than previously. This approach, says The Register, is not compatible with the for-profit model. Meanwhile, Richland Parish, a rural area in northeast Louisiana, is scheduled to host a gigantic new Meta, as in Facebook, data center. Instead of being powered by one of the on-site nuclear power plants that was previously advocated for the facility, the company is opting to drive its massive AI computing workload by burning more fossil fuels. So, when you use your AI, you know, maybe don't inhale. The 4 million square foot, $10 billion facility, hailed by the Louisiana governor as a game changer. I didn't even know Louisiana was in the game. It's one of the largest private capital investments in the history of the state. And is Meta's largest ever data center. Meta has pledged to address the issue of releasing more greenhouse gases with the purchase of offsets, you know, from other companies that are doing better. And that'll happen by the end of the decade, right about the time we have world peace. Hello, welcome to the show.
Faço tudo por amor, tudo por amor.
sua grife de milionário. Abra logo uma igreja, meu bem, um banco, um portel, um ranário. Você faz tudo por dinheiro, eu faço tudo por amor, tudo por amor. Tudo por amor. Tudo por amor.
From New Orleans, Louisiana, where it's really cold right now, but it's cold everywhere. It's almost winter time. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. Speaking of winter, it's really cold in crypto world. Oh, it's a crypto winter. XT.com is a cryptocurrency exchange. It has a reported daily trading value, a volume of $3.4 billion. How does it do that? Volume. It has suspended withdrawals after a suspected $1.7 million hack. The hacks are working. The exchange suspended withdrawals, citing, quote, wallet upgrade and maintenance. At the end of last month, the statement was issued about an hour before the security firm PeckShield reported that XT.com appeared to have been hacked. The company subsequently issued a statement acknowledging, quote, an abnormal transfer of platform wallet assets, unquote. Translated, your fake money's gone. Went bye-bye. Quote, rest assured this will not affect our users, unquote. The exchange, which is registered in the Seychelles, in case you want to check up the registration. The exchange facilitates trading of more than 1,000 digital currencies. Well, that works. The news site Cointelegraph approached XT for a comment. None coming. And a Chinese cryptocurrency entrepreneur who paid more than $6 million for that banana duct tape to a wall, just to prove he's not really crazy, has bought $30 million in crypto tokens from a Donald Trump-backed crypto venture. Tron founder Justin Sun, I found you, Justin Sun, who ate his $6 million conceptual art banana after buying it at auction, said his company was committed to making America great again after buying into World Liberty Financial, which stands to directly benefit the president-elect. Is that a kind of a kind of thing? Buying a president thing? Prior to Sun's involvement, World Liberty Financial had only sold roughly $24 million in tokens. That falls short of a $30 million threshold that would allow a Trump-owned company to begin collecting 75% of net protocol revenues, according to popular information, so they didn't make the cut yet. With the new stake now from Mr. Banana, Trump can reap massive profits to the tune of $18 million. Oh, who is this guy? Justin Sun? Last year, three of his companies were charged by the Securities and Exchange Commission for the unregistered offer and sale of crypto assets and for, quote, fraudulently manipulating the secondary market with a crypto token through extensive wash trading. It would happen on Monday, of course, that's wash trading day, or the manufacturing of interest and sales around tokens to make it appear actively traded without an actual change in beneficial ownership. Sun is accused of orchestrating a scheme to pay celebrities to promote his crypto tokens without disclosing they were being paid to do so. He didn't call me. Celebrities included Akon, Lindsay Lohan, and Lil Yachty. He's also joining Rural Liberty Financial as a financial advisor. So he's business partners with the incoming president. Who is running World Liberty Financial? Well, the president-elect is its, quote, chief crypto advocate. The sons, Don Jr. and Eric, are the company's Web3 ambassadors. And Trump's 18-year-old son, Barron, named after Trump's formerly fake PR persona, is the company's DeFi visionary. Give him a call. Ring him up right now if you could. And Alex Mashinsky, the charismatic co-founder of crypto lender Celsius Network, this week pleaded guilty to two counts of fraud in one of the last cases stemming from the widespread upheaval that shook digital currencies. He was charged last year with artificially inflating the price of his platform's token in a bid to attract customers. Well, he's trying to attract customers. It generated $42 million in personal profits. He changed his plea to guilty at a hearing this week in Manhattan. The collapse of Celsius was one of the earliest harbingers of what became known as crypto winter. Quote, "I know what I did is wrong. I want to do whatever I can to make it right," said Mashinsky. "I accept full responsibility for my actions," unquote. Brr. And now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
The Archbishop of Canterbury, head of the Anglican Church worldwide, has apologized after being accused of making light-hearted comments about his resignation over the abuse of young boys in the Church of England. In his final speech to the House of Lords this week, he had referenced a 14th century beheading that prompted laughter from some of the members of the Lords. And he suggested, quote, "If you pity anyone, pity my poor diary secretary," unquote. The speech was criticized by a bishop who said she was deeply disturbed by the language used by an abuse survivor who said it was, quote, "tone deaf." I said tone deaf. Welby is resigning from his leading role in the church, quote, "in sorrow for all the victims and survivors of abuse after a review of abuse in the church, which concluded that John Smythe, the most persistent serial abuser to be associated with the church, might have been brought to justice had Welby formally reported him to the cops 11 years ago. Now, he says he would like to apologize wholeheartedly for the hurt caused by his farewell speech in the House of Lords, which was made during a debate. Quote, "I understand that my words, the things that I said and those I omitted to say have caused further distress for those who were traumatized and continue to be harmed by John Smythe's heinous abuse and by the far-reaching effects of other perpetrators of abuse. I take both personal and institutional responsibility for the long and re-traumatizing period and the harm that this has caused survivors. I continue to feel a profound sense of shame at the Church of England's historic safeguarding failures." John Ramsay, father of the late JonBenet, and Geraldo Rivera, the late Geraldo Rivera, both appeared on an obscure cable news channel this week. Rivera told Ramsay, quote, "I deeply apologize to you for what you and your family have suffered," in reference to a special Geraldo did way back when. He added, "Mock trials and moot courts are not that unprecedented." He apologized for the mock trial's inflammatory comments and conclusion. Quote, "When I say I'm sorry, I don't apologize for my reporting, but I don't know what happened. I just want you to know I lament contributing to the hurt you've endured. That's my bottom line." Ramsay said, "I accept your apology and thank you." Nobody apologized for sexualizing a six-year-old. And now, a little D'Souza music. Controversial filmmaker and political conspiracist Dinesh D'Souza issued a public apology this week after falsely accusing a Metro Atlanta resident of voter fraud during the 2020 presidential election. He released a film, 2000 Mules, a couple of years ago, which used phone geolocation data and Dropbox surveillance footage to purportedly show so-called mules trafficking fraudulent ballots. The information provided in the film has since been debunked after various investigations. During one of the scenes, surveillance videos show Mark Andrews, his face blurred, arriving at a Dropbox to deposit several ballots. And D'Souza narrates on screen that footage, quote, "What you're seeing is a crime. These are fraudulent votes," unquote. Shortly after the film premiered, state authorities revealed Andrews was legally dropping off ballots for himself, his wife, and his children. Now, over 2 years later, filmmaker is finally acknowledging that it's all fake. On his website, the filmmaker released a full statement, as well as a long-awaited public apology. Quote, while all of these individual images were blurred and unrecognizable, one of the individuals has since come forward publicly and has initiated a lawsuit. I owe this individual, Mark Andrews, an apology. I now understand that the surveillance videos used in the film were characterized on the basis of an inaccurate information provided to me and my team. If I had known then that the videos were not linked to geolocation data, I would have clarified this and produced and edited the film differently. Despite his apology, D'Souza is standing behind the basic premise of the film, that there was widespread fraud during the 2020 election. The Apologies of the Week, copyrighted feature this broadcast. Now this unimportant message.
I went all the way in on the triple payday parlay and lost my shirt. What a thrill.
We were going to go on vacation. Then I discovered Bet Your Life. Better than any vacation and over much sooner, like in a flash.
It's the only sport book that lets you bet on everything. And I do.
Hi, I'm a football player you've never heard of. And I'm here to tell you that gambling on anything has never been more exciting. Bet Your Life lets you bet on players, elections, TV ratings, even on your own job prospects, all from the comfort of whatever you've got left. And unlike other sportsbooks, Bet Your Life has no time or territorial restrictions. Bet what you want, when you want, because our Canary Island computers are always on. So go ahead. The only thing stopping you is you. Bet Your Life. It's America's sportsbook. Bet it while you can.
Gambling problem? Ask your mama.
From Coney Island to the Sunset Strip, somebody's gonna make a happy trip tonight. While the moon is bright, he's gonna have a bag of crazy toys to keep you swinging, little girls and boys. So dig, oh, Santa comes on big. Here come a calling when the snow's the most, when all your cats are sleeping warm as toast. And you're gonna flip when old Saint Nick takes a lick on a peppermint stick. And here come a flying from a higher place, he'll fill the stockings by the fireplace. So you'll have a yule that's cool. To West L.A. He's gonna drive that crazy sleigh tonight, baby, while the moon is bright. He's filled his bags with Christmas toys to give to all your little dreaming girls and boys. So dig, Santa comes on big. He'll come a-calling when the snow's the most, when all your cats are sleeping warm as toast. A lick on a peppermint stick, and you'll come a flying from a higher place to fill the stockings by the fireplace. So you'll have a yule that's cool.
Oh, you have a Yule that's cool. He'll fill your stockings, babe. You have a Yule that's so, 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 so cool.
This is Le Show, and I'm welcoming back to the program today someone who has been a visitor to this program before and recently wrote a quite compelling piece about where we are in our situation regarding government expenditures and government debt, which is something she knows a little bit something about. Her name is Dr. Stephanie Kelton. She's professor at Stony Brook University in Long Island and was chief on the staff of the Democratic side of the Senate Budget Committee in the last decade. And her book about the world since we went off the gold standard, The Deficit Myth, is a bestseller. And she's agreed to be with me here today to talk about that recent article. Dr. Kelton, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
So, as I read your piece, it was an attempt to deal with the demands of those, including a certain Mr. Musk, that government expenditures be reined in, federal government expenditures be reined in, and that the only way to do that was to cut government programs, to cut whatever your particular program target of choice might be. And you had an entirely different angle on how that same goal could be achieved. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy are the two guys that Donald Trump has put in charge of this Department of Government Efficiency, the so-called DOGE commission. And, you know, Elon Musk kind of got out there in front of the president-elect and said he was going to look for at least $2 trillion in cuts. But, you know, it's a little bit unclear, Harry, whether we're talking about, you know, government programs or whether we're talking about other places where the government could spend less on something. And what became interesting to me is that Elon Musk's PAC, the America PAC, put out on X a list of things that they viewed as wasteful kinds of government spending. And on the list was the payment of interest by the federal government to holders of U.S. government bonds, notes, bills, treasury securities. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. It was by far and away the biggest item on the list. And all kinds of people saw that and said, wait a minute, that you can't cut that. You have to cut programs like Social Security and Medicare. Mm-hmm. Why are you talking about interest? So my piece really focused in on whether Musk was actually onto something in identifying interest as an area where the federal government spends an awful lot of money, and almost all of that money goes to people who already have money. And so if we're going to, in fact, go down this path of looking for ways for the federal government to spend less, why don't we spend less on people who are already doing phenomenally well and avoid cutting programs like Medicaid, Social Security, food stamps, Medicare, and the like?
I think people may need a little, I'm sure I do, a little grounding in how the interest rates that the U.S. government pays on its debt is established. Is it the Fed that establishes that interest rate?
Well, the Fed sets a really key interest rate. We usually hear about, you know, every so often you'll turn on the TV and you'll hear Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, and other members of this important committee met and decided to raise interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point, a half a percentage point, whatever. You know, this was happening during the pandemic when inflation was running hot and the Fed was raising interest rates. And what they do is they raise one interest rate, which is their policy interest rate, and they basically just sit in a room together for 2 days talking about how they see the world. And at the end of the second day, they make a decision about whether to move interest rates. And that interest rate that they're talking about is called the federal funds rate. That's the interest rate that banks charge each other for overnight loans. And so the Fed sets one interest rate. That interest rate is often referred to as the anchor for all other interest rates. So we have something called a yield curve. And we have interest rates on short-term government securities like T-bills, longer-term notes, and then the really long-term stuff, 10-year treasury bonds, 30-year bonds, and the like. So it influences other interest rates, but the Fed directly is setting just one key interest rate.
And they don't enforce it, right? It's when you say influences, it's a process of, to use a civilian word, copying going on, as opposed to the Fed sending out a regulation saying this will be the interest rate that everybody else charges.
Yeah, right. So they're setting the interest rate that banks charge each other to borrow in the overnight market, something called to borrow reserves in the overnight market. But they don't explicitly act to pin, let's say, the 10-year interest rate at any particular rate. They could do that. And historically, they have done that during and immediately after World War II. The Federal Reserve did explicitly target the yield curve, meaning they didn't just play with the overnight interest rate and set that one. They explicitly set the short-term interest rate on T-bills, which is like three-month securities, and then longer-term interest rates, the 10-year treasury. And during the war, the decision was very explicit. The Treasury and the Fed said, look, we're spending a lot of money to fight and carry out World War II. We want to avoid, to the extent possible, creating inflationary pressures. We realize that if we're paying out, you know, huge sums of money in the form of interest to bondholders, that all of that money can end up chasing after goods and services, and it can accelerate inflation. So let's don't do that. Let's put a cap on interest rates so that we say we won't pay more than 2.5% interest on 10-year treasuries, and we won't pay more than, I think it was 3/8 of a percentage point on T-bills. And they just anchored the yield curve and controlled interest rates that way. The central bank in Japan, the Bank of Japan it's called, has been doing something called yield curve control for a number of years, and just reminding us once again that if a central bank chooses to do so, it can always operate anywhere on the yield curve that it wants. It can keep long-term interest rates very low, in addition to keeping short-term interest rates low. So the Fed has not gone there. Other central banks have, but it's always possible.
So one question I think we have to answer before we get to your proposed solution to the spending problem is, why does anybody buy a treasury bill?
Well, there are lots of reasons. Maybe one of the most, I suppose, obvious from an investor standpoint is that you get a return, you get interest, and you're parking your dollars in an asset, a U.S. government security, that is default risk-free. So you get a very safe, risk-free return. It's kind of nice, you know, if you've got a bunch of cash and you're thinking, what do? I'm Apple, I'm Google, I'm Amazon, I have huge operating revenues, I had all this cash I have to put somewhere. I'm not going to put it in my checking account at, you know, Chase Bank, because I got FDIC insurance on the first $250,000, and anything above that, I'm at risk if the bank goes under. But with Treasury securities, they're safe. You're protected. You have the full faith and credit of the United States government behind you, and you get a risk-free reward. You get interest for holding those securities.
So from the standpoint of people who are deficit hawks, that is debt, that is punishing our grandchildren. From the standpoint of investors, this is a safe investment.
Yeah, it's so funny. You know, Harry, I hear people talk about the debt all the time, and they look at it from that one vantage point, which is one of the two that you just raised, the burden on future generations. It's, you know, it's something negative. It's a liability. You know, it's got the word debt attached to it after all.
It's something that has to be paid back.
Yeah, it's a debt. It's got to be paid back. It's a liability of the government. What people forget to do is, you know, complete the balance sheet. Balance sheets have two sides, assets on one side, liabilities on the other side. So this thing we call the national debt is nothing more than the sum total. It's a historical record, and it has been keeping track from the beginning of time, from the origin of the country, from the beginning of time, it's been keeping track of how many dollars the federal government has put into our hands, spent into our hands, without taxing them away. Okay? And those dollars exist. They sit in the form of what's really a savings account. Okay? It's called their U.S. Treasuries, their government bonds, and they are our financial assets. Anybody who owns one knows that it's part of their savings, part of their wealth. So on the other side of the government liability is our financial asset, and they add up, you know, they match completely, right? One-to-one. So we pay them back all the time. We never pay off the national debt in its entirety. We did that once in 1835 when Andrew Jackson was president. It happened after a long string of years where the federal government was running budget surpluses, meaning that the government was collecting more money out of the economy each year than it was spending back in. And that was pushing the surplus in the private sector down, 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 until the government had collected so many dollars back that it actually retired all of the outstanding government bonds. So it paid off the debt. And what happened 2 years later? One of the worst depressions in U.S. history. Hmm. Why? Because the federal government siphoned out too much financial wealth from the private sector, and it ended very badly, which it tends to do. So we pay back treasuries when they mature. Bonds mature all the time. T-bills, notes mature. The government pays them off, but it rolls them over. It reissues. And so people have an ongoing place to park their dollars in a safe savings account that the government is providing to us. U.S. treasuries are the Treasury Department's way of letting us place our money in a safe vehicle called a government bond or T-bill or a note, and that's really all there is to it.
So your suggestion in the piece you wrote that I read had to do with changing the interest rate to reduce federal expenditures. Explain that to me a little bit.
So let's do it on the upside, and then we'll be able to see, I think, more easily how it would work on the downside. So when COVID hit, the Federal Reserve dropped interest rates to zero, mm-hmm. exactly like it did after the financial crisis in 2008, 2009.
Right.
So basically, when something goes really, really wrong in the economy in a big way, central banks tend to cut interest rates. And if things are dire enough, they cut interest rates to zero.
Just to interrupt for a minute. So that means you can borrow money for free.
Well, I try to avoid the word borrow because I think it doesn't do a good job describing what's really happening. But yes, let's just go with that. It means the government can issue securities and essentially pay little to nothing in the form of interest to the holder of that security.
Mm-hmm.
So interest rates were zero for a very long time. And with COVID, and then as inflation began to pick up, the Federal Reserve started raising interest rates, and it did so very aggressively. So from zero, they started raising and raising and raising, and all of a sudden, in a fairly short span of time, we got interest rates up to 5.25%. Okay, that's big difference from zero to 5.25%. And so what happened is that all of the securities that were rolling over and new securities being issued in that time were being issued at higher and higher interest rates. So where the federal government would have been paying, let's just say, $400 billion annually in interest income, now all of a sudden it's paying close to $1 trillion annually in interest income. So raising interest rates increases the amount of money the federal government pays out in the form of interest to bondholders and others holding government debt. So in this piece, I'm saying, well, if Elon Musk and Vivek and everybody else wants to have the federal government spend less, why not focus on the thing, the biggest driver of the federal budget as we sit here today is interest expense. It is the fastest growing part of the federal government's budget. So why not start there? Why not say to the Federal Reserve, hey, time to bring rates down sharply? And Congress can do that. Congress can do that. When Donald Trump was president the first time, he more or less did that just by jawboning the Fed. You might remember he would get out there and he would complain on television and interviews and so forth that Jerome Powell was keeping interest rates too high, other central banks were cutting, this wasn't fair, we could have a faster growing economy if Powell would just get on board and start cutting interest rates. So the jawboning, some folks argue, worked because the Fed did start to bring rates down. And as the Fed brings rates down, it means that the federal government ends up paying out less in interest income. So I'm looking, in a sense, for the low-hanging fruit. I don't want to see people who are struggling. The people who put Donald Trump in office this time are mostly people who are making less than $100,000 a year. That's where, you know, the votes that delivered him this electoral victory came from. So it seems to me, you know, people who put you in office didn't do so hoping you're going to level the boom on them and cut the very programs that they depend on, that they're struggling to get by, and these programs are there. So, you know, I'm sitting on the sidelines saying, if we're going to do this, let's find the least painful way to do it. And for me, that's, you know, reducing the subsidy that the federal government is providing every year to the tune of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars to folks who already have money.
So why would, let's go back in history just a couple of years to clarify, why would the Fed, if this is interest is costing the federal government more money, the higher it goes, the higher the rate goes, why would the Fed ever raise the interest rate?
Oh, well, the big reason, if you ask a central banker why they're doing it, of course, they'll tell you that it's the only tool they have to help fight inflationary pressures. So, you know, that's the simple answer, is that inflation picked up in the pandemic. We, you know, had a 40-year high. We hadn't seen inflation that high in four decades in this country. Inflation hit at its peak. The consumer price index, CPI, hit 9.1% in June of 2022. And so the Fed had already been raising interest rates as inflation was picking up. And, you know, this is their belief, is that they've got this one tool and they've got a job to do. Part of the dual mandate that Congress gave the Fed is price stability. And so they're looking at inflation running above the 2% target. And that tells them, you know, the solution is get interest rates up, and that's how you bring inflation down. So that's what they did.
And that, to a civilian, that sounds a little confusing, because you're raising the price of something to lower the price of something else.
You got it. I think voters, you know, voters don't understand. Many voters, anyway, don't understand this. There are polls out there that asked people about interest rates, and people said things like, well, they thought that President Biden was raising interest rates, that he was directly, like, it's his, you know, his decision to mm-hmm. raise interest rates. Mm-hmm. They asked people in polls, what do you think happens to inflation when the Fed raises interest rates? And more than half of the people who responded to the poll said when the Fed raises interest rates, they think it makes inflation worse.
Yeah.
Now you think about that and you go, okay, this is to your point, right? Because people who rely on, let's say, credit cards to buy groceries, put gas in the car and stuff like that. They see interest rates going up. That for them is every much a part of the cost of living as, you know, the eggs on the store shelf or anything else. So it is really a peculiar thing to say that we use interest rates to fight a cost of living crisis called inflation, mm-hmm. when raising interest rates exacerbates the cost of living crisis for so many people. Try to buy a home.
I was going to say rent.
Try to buy a car.
Yeah.
Watching the minimum payment on your credit card balance go up. And interest rates, of course, aren't part of the CPI. They don't get factored in as part of the cost of living.
Could Congress give the Fed other tools to use? Is the fact that interest rates are the only weapon they have the fault of Congress?
You know, they could, or they could just say to the Fed, we are instructing you to hold interest rates. You know, we don't want the 10-year going above 2.5%. Do like we did in World War II. It could say, we don't want interest rates going above zero. We want the policy rate held at zero, and we want it there permanently. You figure out what you're going to do in terms of alternative tools to impact financial conditions and credit and so forth in the economy, and let the Fed figure it out. You know, they've got the biggest number of economists, working economists, of I think any part of government there at the Federal Reserve. They can figure this stuff out. You know, the other thing is, Harry, when inflation did start to pick up, we have for so long in this country just assumed, and around the world, that the job of fighting inflation is up to the central bank. And we hadn't really seen inflation in most of the kind of advanced economies for so many years that nobody was really thinking too hard about alternative toolkits and different ways to fight inflation. We just said, well, if it ever happens to come back, the central bank will sort it out. That's their job. And then it came back with the pandemic. And President Biden published an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, and I think it was titled My Plan to Fight Inflation. And that was already a big departure from the norm, because what the heck is a president doing talking about fighting inflation? That's supposed to be the central bank's job. Mm-hmm. But President Biden published this op-ed, and he said, okay, it's a three-pronged plan. My first item on the agenda is to let the central bank do its thing. I won't interfere. I'm not Donald Trump. I won't get in their way. Let them try. But number two, I'm going to try too. And I'm going to work with Congress, and I'll use executive levers. I see problems at the port. I can see the supply chains are broken. Ships have containers that can't get to port and get unloaded. There are backlogs. I'm going to run the ports 24/7. I'm going to work on licensing for trucking so that we can streamline transportation, get goods moving to where they need to be. I'm going to work on childcare, because I think some of the problems are that workers, especially women, aren't able to go back into the labor force because they can't find affordable childcare options. And if they stay out of the labor force, then that's an employer who's struggling to hire a worker, can't find the workers they need, so they're paying higher wages. That's feeding inflation. So I'm going to work on childcare and a whole bunch of other stuff like that. And then number three, he said, to the extent that the deficit itself might be getting too big and feeding into some of the inflationary pressure, I'm going to work to bring that down. So I think, you know, the supply side, focus on the supply side, which was number two, was really, really key. And having government recognize, you know, that he did things with the Strategic Petroleum Reserve things like that, right? All of a sudden, we had the executive branch thinking in creative ways about how it could lean into the effort to fight inflationary pressure and not just leave it all up to the central bank.
So your proposal is to have the Fed, as it's currently constructed, just say, we're lowering interest rates so we don't have to pay so much money to bondholders, and that will reduce the the overhanging amount of pain for our grandchildren, to use the phrase that's often used, right?
Well, I mean, I kind of think it's almost, I'm coming at this from two different angles. One is, it's a game. For Elon and Vivek, this is just a game. They're, you know, look, these guys are on Twitter asking for a volunteer army to work 80 hours a week for no pay, and they're going to open it up and make it like a game where people can post their, you know, identify your favorite form of, you know, government waste, and everybody will laugh and have a hoot over some, you know, expensive toilet seat or whatever the case may be. So it's a game for these guys. And I'm just trying to say in a public forum, if you want to play a game and you want to find $2 trillion, this is where to find it, right? Just so that someone's on record showing that there is another way to cut government spending that doesn't hurt people, that doesn't impact, you know, lives of people who rely on programs and agencies that might be in the crosshairs. So that's one thing. The other thing is, there is an economic argument here as well. And I think that we are to the point now where the rate hikes have combined with the large public deficits and the increase in the size of the treasury market to the point that we are literally feeding $1 trillion a year, and it's projected to increase over the next decade, in income that at a time when the unemployment rate is low, when inflation is still above 2%, when deficits are already about 7% of GDP, look, cutting interest rates is good macroeconomic policy if you believe that the interest that's being paid out goes to people who can then turn around and drive up equities and crypto and everything in between, and, you know, feed some inflationary pressure. Because a lot of this income that's going to bondholders, people, is getting spent.
By necessity. So what would be the mechanism? The Fed just decides to lower rates? That Congress doesn't have to do anything? The president doesn't have to do anything?
Well, that's the thing. So the Fed has decided to lower rates. I mean, you know, we got a 50 basis point rate cut. That's a half a percentage point. And then we got a small one that followed, a 25 basis point cut. So that's a bit of a reduction. But now we're in a situation where a lot of people are watching and saying, okay, we thought this was the start of an easing cycle, meaning the Fed was going to cut and then cut again, and then next year in 2025, cut three or four more times. And maybe we get down to 3.5-ish percent, somewhere in that range. Now people are saying, maybe the Fed's not going to cut the way we expected next year. Maybe inflation is going to get stuck somewhere above 2%. Maybe all this talk of, you know, tariffs and sweeping tax cuts and deportations that are going to round up millions of people and put them in camps and deport them is going to cause the labor market to experience shortages and then wage pressure and then inflationary pressure. So now a lot of people are looking into the, you know, into the crystal ball and saying, maybe inflation starts to accelerate from here, given all the totality of what, you know, the Trump administration is talking about. So maybe we don't get the rate cuts. And at that point, if it's not a voluntary cut by Powell and company, then yeah, you could, you have two more options. One is the jawboning that, you know, Donald Trump, maybe he tries to fire Jerome Powell. Powell has answered the question, would you leave if he asked you to? Jerome Powell said no. Can he get rid of you? Jerome Powell said no, not under the law. But, you know, these guys are willing to test the waters, I think. Who knows what they might try to do and whether the Supreme Court might agree with them and say, actually, you can, You know, he is an at-will worker, and you can let him go. And then you have to try to find somebody who you could put in who would not just agree with you that interest rates should be lower, but who could also get the other members, the voting members of the Federal Open Market Committee, to vote for those rate cuts. Because it's not one man's decision or one woman's decision. It's a committee. Mm-hmm. So that's harder. The most straightforward way, really, would be if Congress just instructed the Fed. The Federal Reserve is a creature of Congress. When Ben Bernanke was Fed chair, I remember him testifying before Congress, and he said these words. I quote them exactly. He said, "We'll do whatever Congress tells us to do." Hmm. Now, there's this idea that the Federal Reserve is independent and all of that stuff, and they are independent in the sense that Congress doesn't tell them on a day-to-day basis, you know, how to conduct their monetary operations and which interest rate to target and that kind of stuff. But they could. And Bernanke knew that. We'll do whatever Congress tells us to do. So if Congress said, listen, you've hijacked a major part of the federal budget. Interest expenditure is the fastest growing part of the budget. And you guys are, because of your rate hikes, You are forcing us to pay out hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars more each year. And we are Congress. We're the elected body. We want more control over what's happening to our budget. So we're telling you to stop doing that. Get rates down. They could do that.
Hmm. Okay, final question, because you've been so helpful and so remarkably clear in explaining all this to me. Why do we need the Fed at all? There are people on the right who've been saying for years, let's just get rid of the Federal Reserve. What would happen if we did?
Well, I mean, we have the Federal Reserve because the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. And we used to have these things called banking panics, and they happened all the time. And we would have depressions, you know, not recessions, but deep, protracted depressions. And lots of, you know, Wild West in banking and panics and crises and all that sort of stuff. So the Federal Reserve was established really to create what's called an elastic currency, to be able to provide as much liquidity as the system might need in a moment of crisis to keep essentially, you know, banks from failing left and right. Hmm. So you want somebody with that capacity. I mean, we saw it with the failure of Silicon Valley Bank and mm-hmm. a handful of others more recently. So that's important. The Federal Reserve is supposed to be the guardian of the financial system. One of their major responsibilities is supposed to be supervisory and regulatory. I'm not suggesting they do it extremely well, but they are supposed to do that job. They are supposed to protect consumers and businesses, right, by regulating and supervising banks and the financial system. So we need that. Whether it has to be, quote unquote, the Federal Reserve that does that, I suppose one could debate that. But I don't think we need the Federal Reserve to do the job that most people think of as its primary job, which is steering the U.S. economy by adjusting interest rates up and down through time. That, I think, we could do without. In fact, that, I think, has been more disruptive to the economy overall. The discretionary adjustment of interest rates, fine-tuning, mm-hmm. that's led to all kinds of problems, including bank failures and other sorts of things. So it's not, you know, the Federal Reserve per se that's the problem. It's that we've asked it to do things that it really isn't very good at, like steering the overall economy, managing inflation, and we don't rely on it enough or demand that it perform well when it comes to supervising and regulating financial institutions.
Was the savings and loan disaster of the late 1980s due to Fed inaction or impropriety or incompetence?
All of the above.
Okay, good. Glad I had the list. Dr. Stephanie Kelton, you, as I say, you make the arcane so remarkably clear and understandable for those of us who don't really fancy economics as something we spend a lot of time thinking about. I always appreciate your time and your ability to do that for us. And it's a pleasure to talk to you again. Hopefully we can do it again in the future.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's edition of the show. A couple of notes before it really concludes. If you enjoyed the interview with Grayson Gill on last week's program, you might want to check out his Substack newsletter called Sourdough Madrigal. Sourdough Madrigal at Substack. And Dr. Stephanie Kelton has a newsletter on Substack called The Lens. I don't have anything on Substack. The program returns next week at the same time over these same radio stations. I got radio. And on your audio device of choice whenever you want it. Hopefully, we'll all be here then. The tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego desk, to Pam Halstead and to Thomas Walsh, and to the Hawaii desk, Thomas Walsh at WWNO New Orleans for help today's program. The email address for this show. Your chance to get Cars I Talk t-shirts. Christmas is almost here. And also a lot of stuff to listen to and watch and read and enjoy. All at harryshear.com. I'm on X for a little while longer at the Harry Shearer. And I'm on Blue Sky at Harry Shearer. And I never mentioned this, but I do have a hefty, that is to say, full of stuff, YouTube channel you might want to enjoy. Just added these words of wisdom to it from the incoming ex-president, not spoken at the reopening of Notre Dame Cathedral this week.
The kidney has a very special place in the heart.
The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy radio network. So long from the Crescent City.